This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Foundation, Building Climate Equity and Community Resilience, with Allison Brooks, Executive Director, Bay Area Regional Collaborative, Mateo Nube, who is co-director of the Movement Generation, Alvaro Sanchez, Environmental Director, Greenlining Institute, Francesca Vietor, Director, Environment and Public Policy, San Francisco Foundation, and President of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. And I'll now turn you over to our moderator, who's Taj James, Founder and Executive Director of Movement Strategy Center. Taj?
Thank you, Ann. Good evening. I want to start by thanking you, Francesca, and the San Francisco Foundation for bringing this conversation together. This is an exciting moment in the Bay Area because we have new leadership at the San Francisco Foundation. And the foundation has started to ask the question, what is equity and what will it take for us to make equity a reality in the region that we live in? And that's a really exciting and challenging question to explore because we're at a really unique moment in human history. We're in a moment unlike any other moment that the human family has faced, and we've got a set of challenges that we have to, all of us in this room and those of us who aren't in this room, have to figure out how to overcome in terms of figuring out how to do some things that may seem impossible but are well within our reach. I want to start with some wisdom from Dr. King, who reminded us that in a real sense, all life is interrelated. All of us are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality. Dr. King was not a trained ecologist, but he understood that we as human beings are a part of, we're a part of life. We're a part of the web of life. And whatever we do to each other, we do to the web of life. And whatever we do to the web of life, we do to ourselves. And it's a very basic insight. It's a very basic piece of knowledge and wisdom. But when we look at how we've organized our world, our society, our systems, our structures, our systems aren't really organized around that principle of interconnection and interdependence. And as a result of that, we've gotten ourselves into a situation that if we don't figure out how to reorganize ourselves around that principle, the human species might not be around for very much longer to try to figure anything out. So we've kind of got ourselves into a nice little corner here. And the exciting thing is that the Bay Area, as a place in the world full of amazingly talented and diverse and wonderful people, has a unique role, a special role to play, I think, in what is a process of global transformation. And you're going to be hearing today from some of the folks who are playing really powerful and important leadership roles in that global process of transition and transformation, but in a deeply rooted and grounded way. Without any further ado, I'm going to pass it on to Francesca from the San Francisco Foundation, who's going to help us explore a little bit briefly what equity means and how does social equity and climate change relate to each other.
Thank you, Taj. And I just want to say good evening and how honored I am to be sitting up here with four of my real Bay Area heroes on these issues and conversations, because I am continually humbled as I sit in meetings and watch them give presentations and see that the work that they do in community and how it's really affecting the change that I think we all want to see to make the Bay Area a better place and the planet a much healthier and safer and greener place for all of us. So I just want to first acknowledge my colleagues up here. So the San Francisco Foundation, which some of you may know, is a 66-year-old institution, a community foundation based in the Bay Area that focuses on the five counties of the region that touch the Bay. And the environment program is one of the oldest programs of the foundation. And in the last several years, we've really been looking at this question of climate as it relates to the question of social justice, which was part of the founding DNA of the San Francisco Foundation. Recently, we have a new leader that's come on board in the last year and a half, Fred Blackwell. His mother, Angela Glover Blackwell, some of you may know, was the founder of Policy Link, and she is really a legend in her time. And the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, because Fred came to the San Francisco Foundation setting a course for us around equity and really asking us and challenging us to really look at our region and think about these questions that are emerging around the wealth disparity that's growing, around the affordability crisis that we're seeing, around the gentrification of neighborhoods, of communities that traditionally were so diverse and multicultural. And to really look at our programs, our content areas, be it arts and culture, be it health or environment, and say, how are we going to make sure that the decisions that we make, the grants that we make, the communities that we serve, are really incorporating these issues of equity into the issues of the day around environment or arts and culture. At the same time, we've seen the climate crisis growing. The drought, right? I mean, we thought that we were going to get this El Nino. I mean, we were going to get a lot of rain in these last months. We did get quite a bit. February, I don't think there's been any. So it's something that all of a sudden, you're starting to see the signs again to conserve water. It's going to be a major crisis. It's the first year that we're seeing that the governor is declaring not only a state of emergency for flooding, but also for drought. So I think that significant water is going to continue to be a huge issue. At the same time, we are seeing opportunities at the state level, and Alvaro is going to speak to some of this, around energy and policies and investments that are going to be huge. So I think our moment, as Taj said, is now. So one of the ways that we've been looking at this, and there's a slide up here above me, that talks about this cycle of climate inequity. Because one of the great fears as we talk about the climate and the opportunities is to really look at how the climate, as it changes, is going to drive the inequities that our region is facing. We're going to see rising food prices and growing insecurity. We're going to see water scarcity. We're going to see health disparities grow. And as social inequities continue and grow, it's going to actually drive climate change. So as people get displaced from their neighborhoods and move farther away from their communities, they're going to be driving more, and that's going to contribute to the climate problem. As we stay invested in the fossil fuel economy, we're going to continue to emit pollutants into the air, contributing to climate change. So there's this cycle that we have to pay attention to of climate inequity, and really think of what kind of solutions we can come up with to break the cycle. And it's going to be things like green infrastructure programs. So how do we build resilient cities? We build cities for the future that are much more distributed system-based. So we all have when it does rain, we're saving our water, we're reusing our water. We're planting our own food. We're encouraging community gardens, healthy food access in our communities, in our neighborhoods. We're encouraging food security. We're investing in public transit so that people can get out of their cars, so that people who might not be able to afford a car or afford gasoline are able to get on transit and get to their jobs every day. So we're not only helping environmental issues and addressing climate change, but helping low-income communities, communities of color, get to work and support their families with the monies they're saving. So this is a notion we've been playing around with, and I would like, to invite my fellow panelists to respond and discuss some of these issues around the inequities that they're seeing and the connection between climate and social equity, but also to turn it back to Taj and ask a little bit about some of the opportunities that we might be able to think about together and collectively, and what we really need to do, especially from the San Francisco Foundation's perspective, to build the capacity, the community capacity. Who needs to be in the room? Which sectors? How do we engage private sector? We know they need to be engaged. How do we engage the public sector? And I know Allison is going to speak to this from her seat as representing the public sector. And what about our communities, most importantly? And how are we going to lift up those voices and engage them in the decision-making process? So, Taj, back to you. Well,
I'm going to turn it over to Mateo, because one of the assets that we have is that our communities have within them a tremendous amount of wisdom and expertise, both about the problems that we're facing and the solutions that can help us all to move forward. And Mateo is going to help us to explore where some of those solutions are coming from and how they're advancing as different communities across the region and across the world are trying to grapple with these problems together.
Great. Thank you so much, Francesca, for organizing this important conversation. Thank you, Taj, for setting the context. It's an honor and a privilege to be here with you all tonight. It is clear, as both Taj and Francesca outlined, that we're living in an era of tremendous transition, that the juncture we're at, that we happen to have been born into, is epic, and that the nature of human footprint on our planet is literally, at this point, transforming life cycles of the planet. So I'm saying all that because part of what I will focus on is situating, at least how at Movement Generation we define climate equity, because it's very important to appreciate that the departure point of our analysis then informs our journey and our action. So I want to start first by dropping a concept and inviting us to sit with it as the conversation flows through the next hour, which is that social inequity is a form of ecological erosion. I think we're all clear that there is tremendous ecological erosion happening and that has been happening as a consequence of how human settlement has been organized, and that we need to situate social inequity as a part of that erosion. It is not something separate. So that's something I'd like to lead with. So one way we talk about it at Movement Generation is, so this transition is fully on, and climate change is but one expression of that transition. So what we have in front of us in very simple terms is, will change look like a just transition, or are we headed towards collapse? And I say just transition because transition at this point is inevitable. Whether it will be a just transition, whether we will navigate through this transition in an equitable way, is really a central political question in front of us. And I think that's one way to think about the conversation that we're having tonight. Another way of saying it is climate change is a symptom of the crisis. It's not the cause. It is one of the key symptoms that has become very apparent to us, as you know, there were images of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines as one example. Francesca has mentioned increasing drought in California. There are many examples of this. So it's important for us to talk about the cause. And there's actually a very simple word that sometimes numbs us when we see it, the word economy. But it's very important to talk about how it is that we've organized management of home. And I use those words in a very intentional way, and I'm going to explain why. The word eco, if we think about economy, literally comes from the word in Greek that means home. Eco literally means home. And if we think about the system that makes up home, that's what ecosystem is, right? Ecology is literally knowledge of home. And one way to think about the conundrum we're in, and particularly those of us who grew up in cities, is like, wow, we're actually highly illiterate about how home works. So one of our key challenges, and that's part of this conversation and part of the work that I would believe most of us are engaged in, is how do we rekindle true knowledge of home? We can't take care of home well unless we understand it, right? That's a point of departure. And as I said before, the economy actually literally means management of home. So it's very important to appreciate that there isn't such a thing as the economy, which is something we hear of often on TV, you know, GDP and ticker tapes at the bottom and men in suits talking about stocks are going up. Those are all indicators of a particular kind of economy. point being is like we can manage home in many ways, and we can do it very elegantly and do it very well, or we can do it very poorly. And it's all going to be situated on how it is that we're defining home. Y'all with me on that so far?
Mm-hmm.
Great. So then what we need to get back to is a reflexive, responsive, reciprocal relationship with home. And one way we talk about that is, we call that ecological justice. But the conundrum we're in is that what has happened is we're experiencing a globalized mismanagement of home. Meaning, over an arc of time, human settlements have, communities have managed home well or done it poorly. And say 2,000 years ago, communities that did it poorly, maybe they cut the forest that they lived in and suddenly their home became barren and they had to move on or died off. But that was a paper cut for the planet. But what we're experiencing now is we've globalized that experience. It's no longer paper cuts. It's manifesting in things like climate disruption, right? So to then appreciate what we mean when we talk about climate equity, what it means to return to a reflexive, responsive, reciprocal relationship with home, we need to understand how economy works at its basic form. And one way we like to talk about it is about pillars of economy. Any economy, an economy that is working well or that is being mismanaged, has five fundamental pillars. We need stuff, right? We need to build homes. We need to grow food. So all economies require resources. Then the unique resource we humans bring into economies is our work. Right? So all economies deploy work. All economies have a grander purpose. There's a core set of priorities that inform how that economy is organized. And to justify that purpose, we humans create a worldview. And finally, we create a governance that actually enforces that worldview, makes that purpose occur. Yeah? So we could talk about this globalized economy through many different memes. We often talk about it as a banks and tanks economy. But perhaps the simplest way to talk about it is it's an extractive economy. So I'm going to transpose how to interpret these pillars in the dominant economy that has got us to this kind of cliff that we're peering at and we're experiencing consequences and that we're trying to quickly pivot back to a saner way of organizing the economy. One way to talk about the resources in an extractive economy is that it's about dig, burn, and dump. So there is no knowledge of home, or if there is, we're vastly ignoring it. What is regenerative, we're converting into degenerative. We're cutting down a forest completely. We're polluting a waterway. The way work is organized is through exploitation. It's extraction of human labor that is not regenerative. Again, we're taking a resource that is regenerative and deploying it in a way that actually destroys and maims and kills. And the purpose of this extractive economy is the concentration of wealth and power. And obviously, we need a worldview to justify this. And one way to talk about it is there's consumerism, there's white supremacy that's justified, that anchors the operation of this economy. And to enforce it, quite frankly, the governance structure is militarism, meaning if we're going to have an economy that says, oh, that oil that exists under the land that you live on is ours, folks who live there are going to say, wait a second, what are you talking about? Or those folks that live in your community, we're actually going to now take their labor and force them to work for us. In all of those situations, what's the human impulse that's a natural and healthy impulse? Is to resist. And when there's resistance, in order to make this economy function well, you then need something like a vast military force to enforce it. So this is just a way to interpret the economy at its most base form. So the last thing I'll share then is a framework to then, so how do we define a living economy, a generative economy, an economy that is dancing in a reflexive, responsive, reciprocal relationship with place? We then, resources are organized through this concept of zero waste, right? Regeneration. That's how nature works. So how do we organize our relationship to watersheds and food sheds and energy sheds so that that is something that continues staying healthy for ages and ages and ages. And the same thing then needs to apply to the concept of work. How we organize work should be regenerative and cooperative, meaning we, I think, are all familiar with the concept of zero waste as it applies to things, but we need to apply the same concept to how we think of human communities. There can be no disposable human communities, and the fact is that that is how the extractive economy has organized itself. So there are sacrifice zones. There are whole peoples that we're going to consider disposable. If we think about this moment, this historic moment in the U.S. context, that's what the whole movement for Black Lives is about. It's like, you enslaved us. You made us come here by force. You took us away from our home. You took our land away. Then you deployed us to work this other land. And to this day, the consequences of that is still the reality of how this economy is organized. And I talked about militarism. That's what the movement against police brutality, that's what Black Lives Matter means. And if we interpret that through that lens, then in our view, the movement for Black Lives is a frontline struggle for ecological justice. And you can't separate, say, working towards preventing climate change and what is happening as it relates to white supremacy in the black community in the United States. It's part and parcel of reorganizing the economy so that it works for people and planet. And what that sort of makes very clear is that the purpose of economy should be ecological and social well-being versus concentration of wealth and power, and that sacredness needs to be at the root of how we organize our worldview. Most ancestral cultures that are still rooted in place have deep traditions, say, around reverence of water. You go to most places in the world, and there'll be something deeply ritualistic in a deep sense around the river where folks have lived for thousands of years. There's a reason for that. It's all part of organizing human settlement and economy in a particular way. And then we need deep democracy, right, from the workplace to the state house to make an economy work well. So that is all context to the conversation where Alvaro and Allison and some of us will pipe in again about what are very concrete examples about. So what is the strategic way for it to tackle this crisis where, again, climate change is a symptom, not the cause? How do we make equity central to how we reorganize the economy? This is about reorganizing the economy so that it meets all communities' needs and all living communities, so human and non-human, right? So there are multiple ways to think about strategic orientation. One is to pray for rain. Quite frankly, another, which is very manifest, is very interesting that President Obama, when he unveiled his grand plan around climate change a year and a half ago, he did it at a Walmart. And he, amongst other things, was touting the beauty of Walmart choosing to put solar panels on their roof. That's a very deliberate choice. And I would argue that it's very deliberately committed to the extractive economy. And that what we really need to be doing is forging a new way that is actually being manifested in many different communities around the country where we actually reassert deep democracy at a local and regional level and recapture our capacity to manage watersheds and energy sheds and food sheds from the bottom up. So that's the context I wanted to set, I was invited to set, and then I will turn it over to Alvaro and Allison to start really breaking down what are regional and local manifestations of how this is happening. Gracias.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Foundation, Building Climate Equity and Community Resilience, with Allison Brooks, Executive Director, Bay Area Regional Collaborative. And our moderator tonight is Taj James, Founder and Executive Director, Movement Strategy Center, Mateo Nube, who is Co-Director of Movement Generation, Alfaro Sanchez, Environmental Director, Green Lining Institute, and Francesca Vietor, Director, Environment and Public Policy, San Francisco Foundation, President of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Taj?
Thank you, Ann, and thank you, Mateo. We're gonna turn it over to Alvaro from the Green Lining Institute, and what Mateo's laid out for us is a pretty deep, bold, and fundamental shift. And in reflecting on what you shared, in some ways it can feel a little overwhelming, the depth and the scale of the change that's required. And that's why I'm really excited that Alvaro's going to speak next, because he's got his hands deep into the dirt and just came back from Sacramento doing some work up there to try to figure out how to translate what Mateo just laid out into real changes in people's lives on a daily basis. So, Alvaro.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to participate in this panel. It's really exciting to be with folks that really understand the concept of what we're trying to achieve here and are so articulate and so inspirational in the way that they deliver, because that's really what we need in order to kind of get us towards that next step of building the type of economy that Mateo just described. It's ambitious, and it's something that we're not necessarily too prepared to do. In some cases, we don't even really know how to do. But what I'm here to say to you is that, in fact, California is leading the way towards creating this type of economic prosperity that is not an extraction economy, but it's a triple bottom line economy that promotes people, planet, and prosperity at the same time. So many of you might already, I'm sure, know that California is a model across the world in terms of what we're trying to achieve to reduce greenhouse gases in the state in our response to climate change. California has led with a number of policies that are getting us towards that just transition, clean energy economy that responds to the needs of the folks that are most impacted by climate change. So I'm going to get somewhat wonky on you, but bear with me. There are a couple of bills that are incredibly important that you all be aware of. AB 32, passed in 2006. It set California on a path towards reducing our greenhouse gases to 1990 levels by the year 2020. So that bill really started the mechanism that put California on a path towards reducing our greenhouse gases and being a leader on this issue across the world. But that bill kind of just went so far, and it really didn't demonstrate how we were going to be able to use that revenue that was going to that's reducing greenhouse gases by charging polluters for the pollution they emit, and how do we reinvest it in a type of economic strategy that would deliver these types of triple bottom line benefits. So in 2010, a second bill, SB 535, was passed, which regulates the state of California to invest at minimum 25% of the revenues from polluting industries into the communities that are most impacted in California. And it's not just a random definition of what is most impacted. It also charged the state with creating a scientific tool called CalEnviroScreen 2.0 that determines, using 19 pollution-based and socioeconomic-based categories, which census tracts in the state are determined to be most impacted. Cal EPA determined that they were going to have a threshold of the 25% most impacted communities in the state as being the recipients of these funds, and it covers some of the most polluted and some of the communities that are facing the most severe poverty in the state as the recipients of this money. So in the fiscal year 2014-2015, the first year that funding went out to these communities, that totaled to $272 million for clean energy projects in a variety of buckets: affordable housing near transit, solar panels on low-income homes, electric vehicle rebates for low-income riders, increased bus transit for low-income communities, tree planting for a bunch of communities as well across the state. All of these projects are funded by these funds, and we did a study where we looked at 10 projects just to see what kinds of benefits those projects would be able to deliver. Just 10 projects that were funded from these funds are going to produce over 2,000 solar panels on low-income households, are going to create 2,000 new trees in impacted communities that lack green space, are going to provide 252 homes at affordable rates, are going to create 400 jobs, and provide 600 electric vehicles to families that were previously riding a polluting and not very reliable car. So this type of economy that Mateo described so eloquently, we're at the forefront of how we achieve that. And really, the reason why I was chuckling as he was describing this is because I'm not an environmentalist. I did not come at this from an environmental perspective. I studied economic development my whole life, and that's what I've practiced. And the intersection that we find ourselves right now is that, for me, this strategy is not a strategy about improving the environment. It's a strategy about improving people's lives and about improving those that are most impacted by pollution and poverty at the same time. So the second thing that I just want to leave you with is that while this is a great strategy, and while there's a lot of resources that are available and will continue to be available for these types of projects, these communities are also the least capable and the least resourced to be able to achieve and bring those projects to the ground sometimes. And that's where the partnerships that you're seeing here are super important in making sure that these funds are not wasted and create the type of long-lasting impact that we all want to see. So what I mean there is that communities that could benefit the most from these types of investments lack the technical assistance and capacity, and sometimes the understanding of what the state is trying to achieve in order to really maximize the opportunities. That's a challenge that we all have and that we need to confront in order to make this vision that Mattel laid out a reality. But I think we're definitely on the way to being there. And California is being a model that's going to be replicated across the United States in terms of investing money where it's most needed and preventing some of the most egregious damage from pollution, and also helping people create pathways out of poverty. So I think I'll stop there, and I'll turn it over back to Taj for the next step.
Thanks, Alvaro. So you're about to get a treat, because there are places you can go on the internet and you can look at where you live and figure out whether where you live is going to be underwater in the near future, which it may be. And as those of you who pay attention to climate science, the rate at which sea level rise is increasing, surprise, surprise, is faster than the scientists predicted. That's the thing you can always depend on. When they said you had a certain amount of time, the thing you can count on is the next time they talk to you, you're going to have less time than you had the last time. And the trend lines are increasing in all the wrong ways. But this is the problem that Allison helps us to deal with here in the Bay, because if you try to solve that problem in one part of the Bay, what ends up happening is the water just gets pushed to another part of the Bay. So what do you do when you've got different mayors and different counties and across the district? But we actually have to make decisions as a community that are going to benefit us all as a community. And that's the work that Allison does every day. And she needs our help in doing it. So take it away, Allison.
Thank you, Taj. And thank you. And thank you, Francesca, for having me and having me represent the public sector in all its glory. So thank you for that. I'm really appreciative of the work that everyone on the panel does. And I am particularly privileged to have the job I have that is, I view, in service to the public. And it's important that I keep that in mind in my work. And just talking a little bit about, first off, the entity I am executive director of is called the Bay Area Regional Collaborative. It was called the Joint Policy Committee. I am charged with helping to coordinate the regional planning efforts of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, the Association of Bay Area Governments, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, and the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission. Two of them are regulatory agencies. One is in charge of keeping our air clean. The other is in charge of making sure we're, at one point, not filling in the bay. So they were created 50 years ago because of we were filling in the bay with fill and losing it. And now they are faced with a new role of managing an expanding bay. And then two are regional planning organizations that are responsible for helping to implement SB 375 at the state level and help our region plan for integrated transportation and land use planning. So just to talk a little bit about sea level rise in relation to equity, the majority, we are expected, the science is more and more clear that we're expecting 3 to 4 feet of sea level rise within the next 100 years. It's a very uncertain future. We don't know when that's coming, how much it's actually going to be, but our responsibility as regional planners is to take that into consideration. And as we're planning for major transportation infrastructure, this is infrastructure that lasts for 50 to 100 years, and we need to be starting to think about sea level rise and resiliency in that process. The majority of the Bay Area regional transportation infrastructure now, all of our major infrastructure like sewage treatment plants and other infrastructure is along the Bay shoreline. We have a lot of housing and low-lying areas that is subject to flooding and also liquefaction from earthquakes. And in such an expensive region, if we had a major event or even a, you know, semi-major or short-term event and people were displaced from their homes, particularly poor and low-income people, it is nearly impossible to find replacement housing for even a month. But imagine if this was a long-term event. Small businesses, local residents would have no way. They would be lost to this region forever because they just don't have the wherewithal to move back in. And we know we're having huge housing issues and affordability issues. And this plays out when we're starting to factor in major climate impacts and the impacts it's going to have in our community and the ability. Resiliency really is our ability to adapt and respond to trauma. And so people with more resources are able to adapt. That's true even with drought or expensive food. People with more resources are able to adapt more easily than our most vulnerable population. So I want to talk a little bit about engagement and the challenges we have around engaging with community, creating meaningful processes where people can have long-term conversations about the changes that are occurring in our neighborhoods and in our region, and how people can genuinely feel a part of a conversation, feel like their voice is being heard, and are being factored into the decision-making process. And I wouldn't say the public sector necessarily does a great job for that. And on that, and that's why we need partners to help create those processes that people feel a part of. I think there's reasons why the public sector isn't very good at it, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit. But I would say that when engagement happens, sometimes it's too early, sometimes it's too late. Sometimes it happens at the right time, but in the wrong way. And it's often an issue of who's engaging who and who feels empowered to be part of that conversation. And I know sometimes community members feel, and I think that there's a reason why they should, that if you're a public sector person, you're just checking a box. You have a public meeting and you're checking the box. And so there's a lot of distrust that exists on both sides. And a lot of this is around trust. And how do we build trust again into the public process? Or how does the public engage more in the community process and have the community leaders lead that process and feel more comfortable around that? So I think it's about building trust. I think an institution like the San Francisco Foundation could be so critical to being a partner and also providing the resources to keep people at the table over the long term, which is hard. I mean, we all live in communities. I know I should be more engaged in my local community and the issues there. And it's hard. We're all busy. And it's so how to create processes that people feel are valuable to them, that they're actually having an impact and are engaged is important. And I think that's a partnership. It's not any one institution has the ability to do that on their own. And true participatory processes are intensive of time and resources. We have a huge region. We have 101 cities, 9 counties. We have more government than we really need, quite frankly. I mean, there is a lot of government. So I think that's challenging. It's challenging to do it right. It's, you know, often public process can feel like Thanksgiving with your family, too. If you're a staff person with the city, you're not quite sure who's going to come, and you're going to end up having a really messy conversation. Someone drinks too much. It's like, you know, so I think, and that we need to be okay with that uncertainty. I always think we look at the private sector and, you know, there's all these, we're lauding these companies that these leaders that create these hugely successful companies after failing multiple times to create those the public sector is not lauded for failing. It is extremely risk averse environment. Yet we are asking the public sector to take on things, to be adaptive, to be flexible in a brand new environment. And I think our systems are challenging to change, but our systems right now are not really set up to deal with the issues that we're facing now and that we'll be facing in the future. So I would say, giving a little sympathy to the people that work in these agencies, they're well-meaning, but they are, we need to create more of an environment that appreciates flexibility, entrepreneurship in the public sector, making mistakes, testing new approaches, trying things out that in the end may not work, and this need to be flexible in a really uncertain and changing environment, I think, is really important but challenging, because there are reasons why, there's a lot of oversight of the public sector. There's good reasons for that. But how do we create these more dynamic structures? And I think an important way to do that is by working together and in partnership in doing that. And I just want to tout that there's a lot of great work that's going on. BCDC is adapting to Rising Tides program that's really about working with community and stakeholders around planning for sea level rise and flooding. And there's others that I can go on about. But I think I just wanted to talk about the importance of working together to create those opportunities for an ongoing dialogue, not just come to a meeting. We want you to engage on one thing that we're going to make a decision on, but how do we continue to have this dialogue that's really dynamic and complex?
Thank you, Austin. That poses a really provocative question of what does it look like to have less government, but more democracy, more participation, more community power. That's a big part of the transition that that Mateo laid out for us. In the workplace, at home, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, how do we actually have more collective voice to get us where we need to go? It's an interesting paradox.
Thank you, Taj, for the questions you're asking. We actually are at that time for our audience questions, and Taj will ask them, and we will see what the responses are. Taj, back to you again.
We've got some really incisive and insightful questions here. So there are a set of questions that have to do with how do we make sure that the solutions that we're advancing, whether it's solar panels or other innovations that are helping us to deal with the crisis we face, are actually accessible to low-income communities and aren't just accessible to those who already have more access to resources. So that's one of the questions that's coming forward. And how do we actually build the capacity within communities for folks to really participate in this process of moving the solutions forward? So and then we have a set of questions around another unique challenge we have in the Bay. In the Bay, we like our technology, we like our innovation, we like our growth, we like our wealth, and we've come to a point in which the growth paradigm is done, and we're at a point where we can't even grow with equity, meaning just distribute the benefits of growth more equitably. We need a fundamentally different approach on the question of growth, and what does that sort of concretely look like in the process of transition and redistribution. So
we have two really very important questions, and let's turn it over to the panel and see who would like to answer or respond to either one or two questions.
I'll take the easy one, and I'll answer the first one. As it relates to how do we make sure that some of these programs that are providing these benefits really, really reach the ground? Again, the state, I think, has set up the policy infrastructure to be able to target these investments to the folks that need it the most. And what we need now is essentially the marketing, education, and outreach necessary for folks to understand what is available to them and how they can actually go through an application process to receive it. So, for example, the solar panel program that the state manages, all of the money that they receive, and it was $75 million in fiscal year 2014-2015, has to be spent within disadvantaged communities, which are the most impacted. And even within those disadvantaged communities, is targeted at anybody who makes less than 80% of area medium income. So that's the set of folks who are who can apply for these funds and have those benefits come to them. The problem is that, one, a lot of folks don't know that this benefit exists for them. Two, the household stock of the residents that own those properties is not capable of taking in solar panels because your roof has to be to a certain standard and your electrical outlet has to be to a certain standard. So there needs to be kind of like a technical fix to be able to provide them with the resources to improve their physical conditions of their homes to be able to access that. And even though that there's those complications, all of the money was gone. And then last year, they received another $75 million, and the program is outperforming. It has more demand than it can handle. So the money's going out, and folks are actually accessing these funds. But we still need, I would say, we need more money. And then we also need folks to just better understand how these programs function and how they can access them in a much easier way.
Yeah. Anyone else have anything to add to on this question of what it might take to help communities build the capacity to take advantage of these opportunities and access these resources in the transition process?
I just wanted to mention one program that I think is very exciting as an example of what we have, an opportunity that we have both at the state and local level. We're in the state of California, as Alvaro mentioned, we are in this unique position where we're undergoing a clean energy revolution, and it's being driven by our state policymakers, and it's really quite remarkable. Jerry Brown really recognizes that climate change is a critical issue, and a lot of the legislators are following up with bills and funding through the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund to really try and create a reality from what a new generation of clean energy jobs and resources that can be directed to community. San Francisco has a program that it's about to launch that is a community choice power program. And not to get too wonky on what community choice aggregation is, it's been shown that these CCA programs, these community choice power programs, can be the fastest way for cities, municipalities, to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. But not only is it a way for the cities to participate and take action, but the individual can take action. And starting on May 1st, if you're a San Francisco resident, and this is going to be coming to other cities throughout the Bay Area and throughout the state, you're going to be able to choose what kind of power you want, whether you want to be part of the system and the polluting, independent-owned utility system, or be able to pick power that's going to be greener, cheaper, and then down the road, able to build local renewable power in your neighborhood. So there are innovative programs like that at both the municipal and the state level that we need to be tracking, that we need to be, as individuals, supporting and choosing, opting into, as well as really tracking, the impact on community and what we can do at a broader scale.
Allison?
Yeah, I think about this a lot. Here we are in a region. We have 101 cities again, and some of those are really high capacity cities. We're sitting in one right now that doesn't need necessarily a lot of help from the regional agencies. But there are a lot of smaller communities that just don't have the capacity to access the resources for their constituents or their residents, as even though they want to, but just don't have the capacity to do it. So it's a role that I believe the regional agencies could help support in providing, be that intermediary between the state and making sure that our communities are accessing those resources to the best of their ability, and really trying to lift all boats, if you will, because I think related to climate, we're going to be only as strong as our weakest link. So we can't, focus all our energy. We model after, San Francisco is an important leader, but we also need to bring along all of our other communities. And also with the suburbanization of poverty, we're seeing a lot of suburban communities that have a new influx of low-income residents that just don't necessarily have the infrastructure or the service system in place to support them. So this is another transition that's going on in our region and in regions all across the country that we need to keep in mind and set up those systems to support those linkages between state opportunities, regional opportunities, and getting those to the local communities that need them the most.
Mm-hmm. So with all that activity, is that growth, Mateo? Or is that is there something else that we can... A different way to think about that.
Yes, I'd like to detail what we see as a success story that is playing out in the city of Richmond, and by telling that story, then highlight what is a central ingredient for all of this to happen. For solutions to truly take hold, a central ingredient is building community power, meaning community organizing needs to be at the heart of folks reclaiming proper management of home. And if we think about the city of Richmond, it has been a company town for a century, meaning Chevron has controlled that city. And yet, simultaneously, as we talked about, whenever there is a situation like this, it is met by resistance. And the resilient resistance that has played out in Richmond has manifested through organizations like the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, Communities for a Better Environment, both resisting the damage that the Chevron refinery has been doing in the community, while also envisioning and then enacting what the alternative looks like. So one way to think about this equation is at all communities, we need to be dismantling the bad while simultaneously building the good. And in Richmond, we have the organizations already named, along with many others like Urban Tilt, for example, that has already identified and is literally harvesting, plowing and harvesting from 20-plus acres of land, much of it public idle land. And all of these organizations and many others have formed what is now called Cooperation Richmond. And what is Cooperation Richmond? Cooperation Richmond is a entity that is functioning as a co-op incubation center, meaning it is creating, in the here and now, worker-run and worker-owned economic vehicles that are both meeting community needs like building urban gardens or creating, there's one organization, Rich City Rides, that is about bike repair and bike access in the community, and while simultaneously resisting this expression of what has been a company town. And they are succeeding. And what this is a manifestation of is, what does it look like to divest from that extractive economy while literally investing in the new economies that we need to be building? So that is, I think, one example. Richmond is a location that we can build from and learn from. And what I'm describing here is happening in cities around the country. There is a whole network nationally called the Reinvest Network that is supporting this work. There is a national alliance called the Climate Justice Alliance that many of these organizations in Richmond are coordinated through. So there's an effervescence at play. And you know, to land this point, when I talk about building community power, I think it's really useful if we locate ourselves in the here and now. Beyonce wouldn't have dropped that amazing video and done what she did at the Super Bowl if thousands of people hadn't been hitting the streets for a year and a half, calling out continually for Black Lives to Matter in this country. She was responding to community organizing and power building. And in doing so, she created a new platform that we need to fill and continue. It's an iterative process. In the same way that you can think of the Bernie Sanders moment wouldn't be happening without Occupy. The point being is that it is on us, the royal we, to build that effervescence on the streets and demand the world that we truly need in order for it to happen. And without having that at the center of the equation, we fool ourselves into believing that this is possible.
I think that raises a question for me, which building off one of the audience questions here is sort of, how does that... how does the powerful story of what's going on in Richmond, how does that spread? There are a number of places around the Bay and around the world that are really far along in this process of transition. If we're shifting out of a framework of endless growth to a framework of divesting from what is killing us and reinvesting in what is sustaining us and giving us well-being, there are some places that are really further along in this process than others. And Allison, you sort of spoke to it as well. Like, there are certain communities in the Bay that are just much better positioned to move this process along. And I'm curious for anyone who wants to jump in, how do we help those communities that maybe haven't sort of come into this process yet as consciously and explicitly? How do we do that? I mean, this question of folks who are being displaced out of particularly, you know, San Francisco and Oakland into other parts of the Bay, and this sort of suburbanization of a new kind of suburbanization of poverty. Like, how do we actually shift the democratic capacity, the service capacity, the organizing capacity into the places that really are needed? Maybe Francesca. That's maybe you can take that on, since that's part of the mission of the foundation.
Well, and I do think that we're moving more towards a region in a regional direction. We can no longer operate or try and plan, I think, from just an individual, locale, or city-based perspective. It's really got to, we really have to recognize that we're all in this together and that it's a regional approach. I mean, it's you know, I'm a San Francisco native. I've never seen anything like it. And you look at these places that before, you know, were sort of, you know, these communities that seemed way out in the burbs, and, you know, the Antiochs and the Pittsburghs and the Haywards, and, you know, that's where people are moving. So, you know, how do we reach those people, engage those people, dialogue with those people, not just in the public process, but make sure that the resources, you know, are being directed to those communities, so they're building the resiliency, so they're, you know, part of the new economy, part of this you know, clean energy revolution, so they're getting the jobs, and they're getting the healthy food, and they're not being, you know, they're not suffering from drought. And because if we don't pay attention to what's going on from a regional perspective, they are going to be the ones that are left behind. And if they're left behind, we are all left behind. So I think we really have to, you know, look at the region as a whole and come up with some strategies to really elevate these communities, identify who's moving there, and the higher capacity, as Allison put it, you know, cities or areas, you know, need to really help, you know, and what that looks like, and maybe, you know, maybe Alvaro can speak to this a little bit, what that looks like, you know, to be able to support some of these more far-reaching communities of where people are going, I think is going to be critical as we deal with these climate issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're hitting it right in the head in terms of it can be done by one organization, by one city, or by one leader. It really has to be a network, a partnership. And what we're trying to achieve here, I don't want to underplay how challenging this task is. Like, we're really thinking about a new economic model that hasn't been done before, that's a lot more democratic, that's a lot more inclusive, and a lot more equitable. And that's hard, because we've operated for decades under another model that chose winners and losers. So this is really, really difficult, and is really, and because it's so difficult, cooperation needs to happen. You mentioned risk. We need to be risky, and there are going to be things that are going to they're not going to succeed. They're going to fail. And I think, and I want to emphasize that that's okay, because through those failures, we know what we need to improve, and we need to be thoughtful about what we do, and we need to improve upon our failures, but we cannot be scared of trying something different, because the time demands that we do it differently. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of the revenue that the state has, I think that's just one small piece of what needs to happen. And it's an important piece, because a lot of times revenue brings people to the table, and that's great. But it's ultimately it has to be a bottoms up approach, because if it's not, it's not going to be embraced by the people that ultimately are going to be the beneficiaries of what we're trying to do.
I think that brings us to our final question of the evening.
It does, Raj, and you get to ask it, and we'll have it for the panel. Before we do ask the final question tonight, what I wish, after hearing all of the discussion, which has really been very wonderful, is that we could answer all your questions. So for those of you who weren't able to get to your questions, we'll be here after the program. But thank you. We've had some just terrific questions from the audience, and I hope you know that that's what we've heard tonight. So Raj, it's on you to ask that last question.
So one of the pearls of wisdom that has emerged from this movement in this moment is the recognition that to change everything, it takes everyone. It takes all of us. That we're in a moment in which the changes that are underway are going to require all of us to figure out what our role is. What role can we play in moving this forward? So for the folks who are here in this room and other folks who may get a chance to listen to this conversation, I would love to hear one thing from each of you. When you think about someone hearing this, wondering what more can I do? I may be doing a lot, but what more can I do to actually be a part of this process, to accelerate this transition, to change, you know, what needs to change in order to move this forward? Because it does take all of us.
Allison, would you like to start? And then we'll come down the to each of our speakers.
That's a hard question. Well, we live in a participatory democracy, and it's about participation. And it is up, I would say, to the public sector on some level to create meaningful processes, but we can't rely on the public sector alone to create those. So we need to create the partnerships and whether it's at the very local level or a regional level or at the state level to move change and to move the change we need. And those do take resources and they take time. And I think it's important for us to figure out the partners that could also help resource those efforts as well over time, San Francisco Foundation being one of them, but there are many others that could be part of it. And so I'll put that out there.
Thanks, Allison. Alvaro?
I think for me, be open to something new. This is all of the things that we're trying to do are new, they're risky, and sometimes they're very scary because it's shifting the power from where it currently exists. So you have to be open to giving some in the hopes that that actually is going to lift more people out of the situations they're in.
Thank you. Francesca.
I'd like to bring the young people into the room because we live a pretty good life relatively. We're seeing the climate changing. You know, we're seeing a lot of friends are having money issues. You know, we're seeing a lot, you know, water shortages are starting. But this is nothing compared to what the next generation is going to see. So I guess my appeal would be to engage, whether you have kids, whether you know kids, you know, whether your brothers or sisters have kids, to engage the next generation, to get them out into a beautiful space so that they can, to Mateo's point about the sacred, so that they can realize the sacredness of the planet, so they can appreciate water, so they can appreciate a redwood forest, and some of the things that they might not be able to experience if we don't work ourselves to help preserve and protect, but if we don't educate them and show them the importance of, you know, a healthy, green, livable planet.
Thank you. Mateo.
I think the key invitation I would extend is that we really engage in a very lively dialogue and then act on the notion. If it's clear that we need to move from a me economy to a we economy, from a mine economy to our ours economy, that's how proper stewardship will occur. And at the center of this proper management of home is the question of land. Meaning, we are either going to continue down this illusion that the concept of private property rules above all, or we are going to come to a shared understanding that this is a shared stewardship that we need to figure out in an equitable way. And that's playing out in the Bay Area right now. Gentrification and displacement is a direct consequence of a profit and polluted economy. And sure, we can build a whole city that's triple LEED certified, but it's not going to have any black and working class and Latino and immigrant folks in it. It's the same economy, just, you know, creating an illusion built on all of the horridness that is already playing out in socially speaking. So I would say this notion of the sanctity of private property is one that we need to challenge frontally, and that actually the rest of the world has been demanding of us in the U.S. to do, because we, quite frankly, have promoted this unhealthy notion across the world. And all human community that is still centered in sacredness appreciates that it's about the we. It's not about the me. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mateo. So this is Taj from the Movement Strategy Center. And I'm sitting with the power of this moment, with the sacredness of our collective task, knowing that we can do it. It is within us, and just wanting us to take the risks and to be willing to try the new things we need to try. And it's a little, one of our colleagues kind of described this a little bit as back to the future, right? Because the thing, as hard and difficult as it may seem from where we're sitting, human communities knew a lot of this stuff for many, many, many generations. And it's just been a little while that we've forgotten. And in a short amount of time, a short amount of forgetting, we've done some pretty significant damage to ourselves and the rest of the web of life. So I think I take comfort in knowing that the knowledge and the wisdom of how to do this is actually within us. It's in all of our ancestral traditions. We're all indigenous from somewhere at some point. And those folks who stayed connected to the land never forgot the basic principles that are the principles of life. And so I want to appreciate all of you for bringing us back to that basic wisdom and talking about the real immediate and practical challenges of making the transition real in the midst of the moment we're in. So thank you all.
Thank you. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Foundation, Building Climate Equity and Community Resilience. And our thanks to our panel. One of the things that has stood out for me is the creativity that we've heard tonight and the importance of changing our economic model and our environmental models that we have. And I think for myself personally, as Ann Clark, it's been one of the most interesting and provocative discussions that I've heard in moving towards a new direction. So I really want to thank the panel. You put together some wonderful information for us and ideas and concepts. And I especially appreciate, which you have now turned off, the concept of local living, loving environments and environments. Local living, loving economics and environments for life. It's a wonderful, wonderful way to end the our panel tonight. And let me again thank our panel: Allison Brooks, Executive Director, Bay Area Regional Collaborative; Mateo Nube, Co-Director of Movement Generation; Alvaro Sanchez, Environmental Director, Green Lining Institute; Francesca Viator, Director, Environment and Public Policy of the San Francisco Foundation and President of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Thank you so much for the program you've presented tonight, and let's give them a great big hand. Many thanks to our wonderful audience here. It's been a wonderful audience, and as I mentioned, we had far more questions than we could ask, so we hope that we can get some dialogue going around these issues, but they were wonderful questions. You've been a great audience. And to our audiences on the radio and the internet, you can find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org also for multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, and 230 radio stations on national radio networks. Also find audio and video tapes and free weekly podcasts and archive programs. And I ask that you look for our future programs for the environmental programs. On Monday, March 21st, we'll have the San Francisco Green Film Festival, an outstanding showcase for Bay Area environmental films, documentaries, and filmmakers. Monday, March 28th, a conversation about Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal. And one other one that I want you to mark your calendar for is going to happen on Tuesday. Actually, there are two more. Tuesday, April 19th, the Airport Director, John Martin, will speak about the San Francisco's International Airport's commitment to environmental and sustainability. You'll be surprised at the efforts and the work that has been completed at the airport under the direction of Acting Airport Director John Martin. And finally, for April, Wednesday, April 27th, we'll have an April update, the El Nino effect, California water, snowpack, and drought. We should have quite a bit of evidence and research to present to you about what has happened in this El Nino time. So again, my many thanks to the audience here, the panel, and our audience on the internet and who are listening to us. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being with us. Another big hand for our panel, because this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you.